Welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. This year marks the 150th anniversary of the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution that stipulates that all people born in the United States are citizens and that all citizens have the right to equal protection under the law. Radical Republicans back in 1868 are credited with writing the amendment, but what's usually left out of that story is how free blacks, many of them former slaves, were instrumental in forming the legal ideas of what would become citizenship, and they did it in what were known as colored conventions, some three decades before the 14th Amendment was ever ratified. And in these conventions, they would provide what would become the legal underpinnings of what citizenship means today. Today, we're going to have a conversation about that history today as people are once again debating on what citizenship actually means. My guest is Martha Jones. Martha Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professors at Johns Hopkins University. She teaches history there, and she is the author of the book Birthright Citizens, Race and Citizenship in Antebellum America. Martha Jones, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. When we say birthright citizens, what that just basically means is if you were born somewhere, you are a citizen of where you were born.
Yes. Birthright citizenship is an old idea that takes shape in the United States in the early decades of the 19th century, and it comes to be formalized or constitutionalized in 1868 by way of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. And yes, that amendment makes any person born in the United States a citizen of the United States.
And obviously we're going to be talking about the United States here, but you said it's an old notion, an old idea. Does it predate the United States? Do we find it before in other places around the world?
Sure. There are precedents that go back to British law, English law, European law, and it reflects an old question or an old problem, which is how do we discern or how do we define who belongs, who's subject to the requirements or the demands of a empire or a republic or a democracy, but who also will benefit from the privileges that come with being a member of the body politic. And birthright citizenship is one of the ways in which emerging republics in the late 18th and early 19th century begin to determine who is in and who is out. Compare it to a regime that would be determine citizenship by way of blood, right? So you are a citizen if your parent or your parents were citizens. That's a different sort of regime. But in the United States, we settle on birthright citizenship in part to resolve the position of former slaves in the United States and to formalize their belonging.
And is what significant about the 18th and 19th century for citizenship and the way we get this birthright citizenship is, does that correspond with, this is really where we start to see the formation of a modern state?
Absolutely. And so as it becomes more typical and more apparent that benefits and rights and privileges flow from membership in the body politic, it becomes increasingly necessary to determine who is in and who is out. I should say in the U.S., we have two approaches that emerge in the 19th century. One is birthright citizenship, which we've begun to talk about, and the other is naturalization, right? That immigrants, in particular European immigrants to the United States in the 19th century, will become citizens not by way of birthright, but by way of naturalization, terms and procedures that will be defined by Congress and will make them also citizens of the U.S.
So again, it's what's interesting, what defines now birthright and citizenship in this country is the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution that comes in 1868, long after the founding of the United States. And after the Civil War, the Constitutional Convention, if we go back to 1789 and even in the Constitution before, never actually took up citizenship.
Yeah, it's one of the curiosities that leads me to write birthright citizens, is that we have this long period from 1787 until 1868 where there is no formal constitutional definition of who is a member of the nation. And that leads to a series of missteps, messy circumstances, and some real burdens for people who occupy an undefined status with respect to the nation. But we live for a long time in exactly that kind of ill-defined regime. Some people might be familiar with that provision in the Constitution that requires the president to be a natural-born citizen. And some people will look at that provision and say, well, if the president is a natural-born citizen, there must be such a thing as a more general category, but we really don't get to that in a formal sense until 1868, as you said.
Yeah, it's never defined what a citizen is. Was it needed before then? I imagine you can argue it could, considering just the Black experience informing what a citizen would become.
Absolutely. And it is the circumstances of former slaves. So by the end of the 18th century, we have in the United States, throughout the country, the emergence of small but growing communities of free African Americans. And it is these communities that really put on the table for the nation the question of citizenship. By what criteria one is a member of the body politic, and in particular, whether race is a disqualifying characteristic for the purposes of citizenship. And it is African Americans who feel not only the necessity of being full members of the body politic, but are also feeling pressures, frankly, to leave the country. That there are two forces that are pressuring them to, in essence, self-deport. On the one hand, it is what we call the colonization movement. This is a movement that dates back to the 18th century in the United States, conceived by many of the leading figures of our nation, including men like Thomas Jefferson. Colonization takes the view that slavery will eventually end. It may take decades, but it will end. And when it does, there is no place for former slaves, no place for people of African descent in the United States. So colonization societies organize to remove former slaves voluntarily, a little bit by coercion, a little bit by enticement, but they organize to remove former slaves, deport them to Africa, or to the Caribbean, or to Canada. That's one pressure. On the other hand are what we call black laws. These are mostly state laws that begin to regulate very tightly the everyday lives of former slaves. Their jobs are regulated. Their role in the economy is regulated. Their ownership of property is regulated. Their organization of churches and fraternal organizations. All of these aspects of daily life are very tightly regulated in the early decades of the 19th century. And this becomes a second sort of pressure on former slaves to leave the country. Well, it might not surprise you that former slaves object. Many of them are second and third generation Americans, if you will. They look for an idea, a principle that will help them resist this pressure. And citizenship becomes that principle. They begin to scrutinize the Constitution, to claim to be natural-born citizens like the presidents, and they see no color line in the Constitution because there is none that distinguishes between black and white Americans, and they begin to assert birthright citizenship in a campaign that takes them all the way up to the post-Civil War years.
I want to unpack all those things you just pointed out because I think they're important elements. The colonization aspect, the forced deportation, also the conditions were progressively, and that's interesting and important to remember, were progressively getting worse for free blacks in this country. Why is Baltimore so center in the story that you tell?
Yes, Baltimore is central here, and it's partly geography. Baltimore is a city that sits right on the border between slavery and freedom, right? Maryland is a slave state, but in the north and west of the state, slavery has really fallen away in significance as an economic institution. So Baltimore helps us to see what is a large, growing, and what will become the largest free African American community in the country, rivaling places like Philadelphia to its north or New Orleans to the south. So Baltimore lets us see, I like to think in slow motion, the kinds of challenges that former slaves are up against in this period. Baltimore is also home to some of the nation's most influential legal elite in this period. So it's a place where, for example, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Roger Taney, makes his home in Baltimore. William Wirt, who is the best remembered of the early attorneys general of the United States, is a Baltimorean. And these sorts of men who are deciding in law and policy the future of former slaves are, in a sense, learning these questions on the streets of Baltimore, and I wanted to know more about what they knew, what they saw in their everyday lives, and how we could better understand their jurisprudence, right, their formal lawmaking through the lens of the everyday life of a city like Baltimore.
And that's fascinating, because on one hand, it's Baltimore where you get these intellectuals who are forming these ideas for citizenship and what citizenship means to be obtained by free black people in the country. And yet it's also the city, as you said, of Roger Taney. And people will recognize his name for his infamous Supreme Court decision in 1857 of Dred Scott, in which he wrote that free blacks could not be citizens of America.
That's right. And I began this book in part because I was, I think, like many who read the Dred Scott decision, I was provoked by Taney's claim that no black person could be a citizen of the United States, including a free black person. I was provoked by this, and I really wanted to know what that ruling meant, what that idea meant in the eyes of African Americans themselves. We know a lot about the ways in which judges, lawyers, and other leading figures of the period thought about and debated the issues in Dred Scott, but we knew less, I think, about the ways in which more ordinary African Americans were also thinking about the same sorts of questions that Justice Taney is trying to think through in his decision.
Now, his decision's 1857, and much of the story you have to tell is sort of the 1820s and 30s, not exclusively, but when we're seeing the formation of the ideas of which free blacks in Maryland and Baltimore are thinking about concerning what citizenship is. But do you think in 1857 that Taney's decision in Dred Scott was a response to what was happening in Baltimore?
I very much do. And you've sort of lit on what happens to a historian like me when she begins to dig into the records. You think you're going to write about 1857 and the moment of Dred Scott, but it turns out the people I write about say, not so fast. We've actually been thinking about this for a very long time. And it is these characters, these free African Americans in Baltimore, who pull me all the way back to the 1820s, who show me that long before Taney, they have, in essence, set the terms of a debate. And you are right that Taney's decision in Dred Scott is very much a response to the kinds of claims that they have been leveling, the kinds of arguments that they have been crafting, and Justice Taney attempts in Dred Scott to decide or to settle that dispute, though, as I reveal in Birthright Citizens, he's not very successful.
And of course, he's the one we remember, Roger Taney, and
yes.
Everybody knows the name, the Dred Scott decision. Yet what you did is you found the deeper story.
Yes. And
the more important story.
I would like to think so. And I hope readers will tell me if they agree, because I think that one of the misunderstandings or one of the myths about African Americans in the period before the Civil War is that they were outside of law. They had no formal legal training. They had no ability to serve as lawyers or clerks or judges. And so we could assume that they were outside of the story. So what I began to do was look at the everyday goings-on of the courthouse in Baltimore and discovered, in fact, that was not the case at all, that the courthouse was filled with African-American claimants, bringing all kinds of suits in their city court, and then at the same time gathering in a movement that we call the colored conventions. This is their term, colored, in this period, the colored conventions, where they are full-throatedly engaging the very complex legal questions around the Constitution and citizenship and developing arguments that then take hold in the Civil War era and become incorporated into the Constitution. So I do think it's an important story because it reminds us that the history of law is not simply the history of the text. We can't learn the history of citizenship simply by reading the Constitution, nor can we learn the history of citizenship simply by reading the Dred Scott decision, even as we should read both of those texts. That the real history of citizenship is this debate, is this dispute, is this campaign, and African Americans play an essential role, I think, in that story.
Inform me what our ideas and our legal ideas now are of citizenship.
Absolutely. And their ideas, their principle, right, birthright citizenship, is the primary door to citizenship still today in 2018. All Americans are subject to a transformation that is driven by the ideas and by the demands and by the needs of former slaves.
And it's this history that we're diving into that will culminate in the creation of the 14th Amendment. You mentioned the colored conventions. Can you tell me more about those and where did they happen?
Absolutely. The colored conventions take hold at the beginning of the 1830s. Their first meetings will be in Philadelphia, but across the century, the conventions will meet in many places across the country. These are, if you will, shadow conventions created by men, mostly men and some women, who are excluded. They are excluded from the halls of legislatures. They are excluded from the deliberations of the political parties, and yet they recognize that they have a profound stake in all of the questions that are debated in those kinds of forums. So African Americans create a convention movement to galvanize their communities across the many cities where, as I described, free African American communities are growing up, to develop their ideas, to teach one another in a systematic and in a self-conscious way about questions of law, questions of policy, questions of politics, questions of political economy. And these conventions will meet all throughout the antebellum period, sometimes nationally, sometimes statewide, sometimes locally. And after the Civil War, of course, now African Americans from the South are going to be at liberty to join the conventions and participate in them. We're very lucky in that the delegates to these conventions are aware, in a sense, that they are making history.
Hmm.
And to do so means to make a record. And so we have in pamphlet form the deliberations, the proceedings of these conventions, and they've survived. And so we can read in great detail what transpired there. And there's a wonderful project at the University of Delaware, the Colored Conventions Project, that has digitized those convention minutes and makes them available to anyone.
We are in conversation with Martha Jones. She is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor at Johns Hopkins University, where she teaches history. She is the author of the book, Birthright Citizens, Race and Citizenship in Antebellum America. Martha Jones, you mentioned how they, in these colored conventions, dealt with issues around the press. The press is an important aspect in this story. And in particular, I want you to tell me about Freedom's Journal. Freedom's Journal is the first African-American owned and operated newspaper published in the United States in New York City, started in 1827.
Yes. Freedom's Journal is published in New York, but circulates throughout the Northeast, but also down the seaboard to the city of Baltimore, the city I study. And it is a vehicle for sharing ideas and opinions, certainly. But it turns out that Freedom's Journal is also a sort of primer from the beginning, primer in law. Freedom's Journal, in its masthead, from the beginning, holds up the understanding and engagement with the Constitution as one of its central missions. And people, African Americans, but also other readers, will pick up Freedom's Journal, and it is indeed a kind of lesson book in how to understand, how to read closely, how to interpret a critical document like the Constitution. It is a place for sharing news, and it is the way in which Baltimoreans who continue to live in a slave state develop their understanding of the ways in which freedom is being manifest in neighboring places like Philadelphia and New York. But it is also a place for learning the ways in which race and citizenship and rights is developing throughout the Americas, because in some sense there's nothing new or unique about what's happening in Baltimore when we look at slavery across the Caribbean or South America. In many, many cities, Havana in Cuba, Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, Veracruz in Mexico, these are all places in which there is a transformation afoot as former slaves begin to participate in the everyday lives of these cities. And Baltimoreans are reading for that kind of news also in a place like Freedom's Journal.
And this is where they're learning about what happened in Haiti or even the French Revolution.
Absolutely.
And of course, it's the French Revolution where we do get some very modern ideas of citizenship.
Absolutely. And so here we get the sense of the ways in which even folks in a slave-holding state like Maryland, in a city like Baltimore, can become really cosmopolitan in their sensibilities and judge their circumstances not simply by what they're told, right, in their local scene, but by the kinds of claims, radical claims, right, being made by enslaved people and free people of color in the French colony of Saint-Domingue, or today's Haiti, absolutely. And by the 1820s, of course, there were going to be refugees from Saint-Domingue in Baltimore who are going to be part of this political culture. And so because Baltimore is a port city, you asked me why Baltimore matters, partly because it's a port city. And seafaring is one of the principal occupations for African-American men in Baltimore. And it is the port that brings in not only ideas, but people with varied experiences related to race and rights in the Americas. And that also is folded into the mix in Baltimore.
And the reason I got so excited about the French Revolution, because of course with the French Revolution, everyone starts calling each other citizen.
And, absolutely.
And in that, and you know, it was through the French Revolution that in Europe, France would become the first country to give citizenship rights to Jews in Europe. But even at that same time, while the revolution's going in the revolutionary period, the people of Haiti are saying, hey, we want our freedom. One in slavery, which they would for a short time, at least until when then you get Napoleon. But then, of course, after Napoleon, you have the rise of the rebellion in Haiti led by Toussaint Louverture.
Yes. So in a city like Baltimore, there is a important and keen awareness of the Haitian Revolution itself, right? That possibility that former slaves and enslaved people might take the future of a colony, the future of a nation into their own hands, as is the case in the example of the Haitian Revolution. You're right that the ideas that are part of the French Revolution, but have also been to some degree a part of the American Revolution, are what African Americans in Baltimore are pulling on as they not only make the case for citizenship, but they look for, if you will, allies. And the Haitian Revolution is a hard example in the sense that it is powerful and it makes manifest the ways in which revolutionary ideals, Enlightenment era ideals around equality can be transformative in the lives of people of African descent. But there is also, not only in Baltimore, but certainly in Baltimore, a profound resistance within white civic leadership, a profound resistance to any sort of ideas that might open the door to the sort of thinking that fueled the Haitian Revolution. And so we have in Maryland state laws, these black laws that I've mentioned, that make it essentially seditious to possess anti-slavery materials, even historical materials, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. These kinds of materials are outlawed by black laws precisely because white civic leaders fear the Haitian Revolution and the example that it sets for slaves and former slaves in Maryland.
I think this is an important point you are bringing up about the black laws. Things in the early 19th century, 1820s, around this period of time, things are actually getting more difficult for free blacks than much more difficult, even than more difficult than even after the Revolutionary War itself.
That's right. You know, African American men, free African American men in Maryland vote for a brief period until the first years of the 19th century, when for the first time the word white will be inserted into the state constitution as a qualification for voting. So there are men in my story who have a memory of that period when they in fact did enjoy political rights in the state of Maryland. And so there is a way in which the 19th century is a disappointment, as not only are their voting rights revoked, we have the emergence of black laws that regulate their lives, colonization schemes that in Maryland are supported by the state legislature that hope to prod them or push them out of the state and out of the country. And by the eve of the Civil War, we even have what I come to call radical colonization advocates, men in the state legislature of Maryland who not only want to coerce or persuade free African Americans to leave the state, they would like to pass legislation in 1859 that would forcibly remove African Americans from the state. And this sort of thinking, while it's always been present, really takes a hold on the eve of the Civil War. And African Americans are deeply alarmed because they are familiar with the example of Indian removal. Many of them had watched as Native people had been forcibly removed from the southeast of the United States. And so while today the wholesale removal of African Americans might seem like a far-fetched idea, in the 21st century, in the 19th century, the example of Indian removal only reinforces the sense that the state can organize itself, mobilize itself, and use race as a category by which it physically excludes people.
I really can't help but see parallels to what was happening in the 1820s, 1830s, and I guess all the way up to the Dred Scott decision, and seeing conditions deteriorate more and more for free blacks in the country, as and to see the parallels of that with what we saw in Reconstruction in the South, and how Reconstruction got off to a good start but then totally failed and things got really terrible for then free blacks in the South, what, 50, 60 years later.
Yeah, well, thank you for remembering Reconstruction, because I think today, for some Americans, it's almost unimaginable that we actually lived through an important period after the Civil War where this nation practiced in a full-throated way an interracial democracy, where African Americans became citizens by way of the 14th Amendment, had their voting rights protected by the Constitution, began to hold office in this country by the hundreds and the thousands, right, 2,000 that we know of, black documented black office holders in the United States during the short period of Reconstruction. And so the folks I write about who have waged these struggles before the war now are in a new moment in Reconstruction, and they seize it, and so we see them, and I am able to tell in the conclusion to this book some of what they do, which is everything from creating their own militias and comporting themselves like weapons-bearing citizens, former slaves who are also former soldiers, now organized into militias in their local communities. We see them lobbying and insisting on public education, and in some cases integrated public education during Reconstruction. We see them coming into courthouses and challenging those black laws and asking courts to declare them now unconstitutional in the wake of slavery's abolition and in the wake of the 14th Amendment. So Reconstruction is a moment in which we see the desires, the aspirations of former slaves blossom and really take their full shape. We appreciate that they've been studying law a very long time, and it shouldn't surprise us that they seek to not only participate in constitutional conventions now, but Republican and in some cases Democratic Party conventions in this period. We see them holding office, as you said, in Washington, in the Congress, but in the many states and in localities. We see them holding positions like that of the sheriff or the collector of the customs. And so this is a moment in which the aspirations that have long been held by former slaves really are able to blossom. And you are right that it is a short-lived period. Reconstruction puts into place a constitutional revolution that we live with today by way of the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendments, right? The abolition of slavery, the establishment of citizenship and equality by the Constitution, and then voting rights for African Americans. But it will be violence and subterfuge and the pulling back of federal support and federal intervention in the southern states that will bring Reconstruction to a tragic end by the close of the century.
We are in conversation with Martha Jones. Martha Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor at Johns Hopkins University, where she teaches history, and she is the author of the book, Birthright Citizens, Race and Citizenship in Antebellum America. I just want to quote the 14th Amendment here quickly, and just section one. There are more sections, but just section one, I think that's what we're talking about. All persons born or naturalized in the United States are subject to the jurisdiction thereof, are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges of immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Let's talk about the intellectual underpinnings that would come from Baltimore to get us to that last statement. And I'll just throw this out there, but feel free to go where you want with this. But what I'm thinking is there's an important document 30 years before this amendment, 1838, known as the Rights of Colored Men.
Yes. Yes. William Yeats is an abolitionist who works very closely with free African American communities in the 1830s. And out of his alliance with those communities, he publishes the first legal treatise on the subject of the rights of colored men. And Yeats pulls together the many pieces of the argument that African Americans have been making. He looks at court decisions, he looks at constitutional conventions, he looks at political deliberations, he looks at the record of Congress, and he pulls together the first and a very powerful document that formally makes the case in a form that lawmakers can really understand, which is the legal treatise. And you're right to draw a line from Yeats in 1838 all the way to the 14th Amendment, because it is the same sorts of ideas about citizenship as birthright, about the equality of citizens, that are in essence formalized and become the law of the nation in the 14th Amendment. Oftentimes when we tell the story of the 14th Amendment, we attribute it to the radical members of the Republican Party in Congress, who are responsible for the drafting, the passage, and the campaign that ratifies the 14th Amendment. And that is an important chapter in the story. But what I hope Birthright Citizens helps us see is that we don't get to that moment in 1868 without this early activism, without the alliance of men like William Yeats, who pens his treatise, without that pressure, without that insistence. You know, the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, and there are some who would have left the question there, would have left former slaves free people, but without any formal rights, without any relationship to the Constitution, and subject to what emerge after the war is what we call black laws. They look a lot like, black codes that look a lot like the black laws of the pre-war period. So here, the 14th Amendment is essential, and it's a dramatic story in its the proposal and the ultimate ratification in 1868. But it doesn't exist as a story without these early decades of activism and these early decades in which men are working out this idea of birthright citizenship for themselves.
Well, what did citizenship for these people mean? How did they view what citizenship was?
I think first and foremost, citizenship meant the right of residence. To be a citizen meant that no one could arbitrarily or by force remove you physically from the nation. You had a claim to place. Citizenship meant you could travel. You could come and go at will between the states. This is not the case for former slaves before the Civil War. So the right to travel, importantly, to travel to Washington and to petition the government when one has a grievance or a claim, is part of citizenship. The right to sue and be sued, to come into a courthouse and protect your person, your property, is an essential dimension, a civil right that comes to be articulated through the Civil Rights Act of 1866 after the war, but is one of the essential claims. The right to serve on a jury, right, to be wholly a part of the judicial process by sitting on a jury. The right to testify in court. African Americans, by way of black laws, had been kept away largely from the witness stand in local courthouses because of black laws again. So these are the civil rights that are first articulated by former slaves in their conventions and in treatises like that of William Yeats, become part of federal law in 1866 by that year's Civil Rights Act, and will become implied by the provisions for equal protection of the laws in the 14th Amendment.
We are all beneficiaries of this work that was done
today. Indeed. And we understand that not all of us in the 21st century carry the 14th Amendment in our pockets as we make sense of our everyday lives. But you're right to point out that the equal protection of the laws, which is put into the Constitution to address the circumstances of former slaves, comes to extend to all Americans, and is at the core of the rights of women or the rights of gay and lesbian people in the United States today. That is the long story of the 14th Amendment, that has its beginning in the story of former slaves. Birthright citizenship, something that many Americans take for granted, as having bestowed upon them belonging, permanence, the right of residence, civil rights, again, has its origins here in the Civil War period. And we all, or I should say not all, right, but many of us benefit from this transformation that is 150 years old now today.
How does this history for you, Martha Jones, especially the deep history behind the 14th Amendment, does it inform at all how you see this debate that's occurring today as to whether or not children who are born in the United States but born to the parents of undocumented immigrants, if they have a right to birthright citizenship?
Absolutely. The first thing to say is that the critics of birthright citizenship today point out that in many parts of the Western world, Europe in particular, birthright citizenship has been abandoned. The U.S. is accused of holding fast to an old and outdated regime. And I think before people draw conclusions, we first need to remember that in the United States, unlike in Europe, we come to birthright citizenship out of the experience of slavery as a remedy, as a way of doing justice to former slaves, millions of former slaves in this country. And that further, what birthright citizenship has done for us has ensured that the government cannot use arbitrary differences between us to decide who's a citizen and who's not. So race does not determine one's citizenship in the United States. Religion does not determine one's citizenship. One's heritage does not determine one's citizenship. Even one's political affiliations are not determinative of citizenship. And so we have created a kind of equality and access to citizenship that only comes to us by way of birthright. So that is, I think, one important point.
That's pretty profound.
It in fact is. It's to say, for example, one can even be in a historical moment the member of a despised community, right? In the late 19th century, this is the case for Chinese immigrants and their children. But still, the children of Chinese immigrants are citizens of the United States. Racism cannot deprive them of citizenship. We would say perhaps in the early decades of the 20th century, after the Second World War, the children of those said to be adherents to communism or members of a communist party or advocates of communism, their children are still children. They are still citizens of the United States. And we can go on, right, in our own time, right, the children of Muslim Americans, even as that community faces profound racism and discrimination, those children are citizens of the United States, that the state cannot use the hatred of the day, right, to deprive people of citizenship. Birthright is powerful and it is egalitarian. And in our democracy, it is really a bedrock. Now, I mentioned Chinese Americans because their example really speaks to the question you posed about the children of unauthorized immigrants today. At the end of the 19th century, Chinese immigrants are ineligible for citizenship, even through naturalization. The Chinese Exclusion Acts deems them people who can never become citizens of the United States. Well, what about their children when they are born in the United States? And what begins to happen by the 1890s is that when those children born in the U.S. leave the country, some of them to go to China, for example, to visit family or to do business, when they try to come back to the United States, they're stopped at the border by customs officials. And those officials say, we don't think you are really citizens. And, well, they're born in the United States. Why not? Well, there's a provision in the 14th Amendment that you read that excludes from birthright citizenship people who are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Now, when Congress wrote that, it was thinking about the children of foreign diplomats. It was thinking about the possibility that there might be children of foreign armies in the United States. It was thinking about Native Americans who were citizens of their own sovereign nations in this period. But customs officials look at that provision and they say, well, we don't think the children of Chinese immigrants, people who can never be citizens, should be citizens, can be citizens of the United States by birthright. And this case goes to the Supreme Court in the case of U.S. versus Wong Kim Ark. And the court looks at Wong Kim Ark, who is the child of non-citizen immigrants, and says, no matter. The 14th Amendment is clear. Wong Kim Ark is born in the United States. And so even as his parents can never be citizens, he is a citizen of the United States. And that is the regime that we live with today.
Sounds like the exact same debate, the exact same argument that people who want to take birthright citizenship away are making.
Right. Yeah. So some would say we should interpret this clause in the 14th Amendment to exclude the children of unauthorized immigrants. That seems like a real stretch, given what the court concluded in the case of Wong Kim Ark, that it is birth on U.S. soil that makes one a citizen, irrespective of the status of one's parents. There are others who would have us rethink and even repeal the 14th Amendment. And that opens the door to, I think, this problem that I suggested, which is, do we want to open the door to discrimination? Do we want to open the door to the scrutinizing of one's religion or one's wealth or one's family origins or other arbitrary human differences? Do we want to really open the door by repealing the 14th Amendment, by abandoning birthright and introducing another sort of citizenship regime? That might be the debate that's on the horizon. The Constitution is a complex document to amend, and so that won't be a simple decision. It will take an act of Congress and then the ratifications of 75% of the states. But we are in that debate, and we can hear it in law review articles and on Twitter and on the op-ed page of the Washington Post. It is a real debate, but I hope that reading Birthright Citizens will help some of us to recall the origins of birthright citizenship and appreciating how it has strengthened our democracy rather than diminished it.
Martha Jones, as we move to wrap up, I just want to go back to how I thought you eloquently laid out the importance and how deep birthright citizenship is in preventing the government from being able to divide people. That notion, was it present amongst these mostly men, I guess, that you write about in the 1820s, 1830s, people like Charles Hackett, someone we actually didn't dive into who he was, but an important member? Were they talking about these very things?
Absolutely, because former slaves are, if you will, students of citizenship, of national belonging. They have to be because they are so at risk in these terms. And they appreciate the ways in which citizenship provides protections and guarantees to some and makes others profoundly vulnerable. And so it's absolutely necessary that they think certainly about their own circumstances, but the circumstances of many people in the nation. They understand the vulnerabilities of Irish and German immigrants to the United States, who are coming in this period by the tens of thousands through the ports of New York and Boston and even Baltimore. They are cognizant of why those immigrants come into the courthouse and become naturalized citizens of the United States, because it provides them rights and protections that former slaves also desire. As I mentioned earlier, they are studying the case of Native Americans and appreciate the ways in which Native American, the status of Native Americans had made them especially vulnerable to removal as non-citizens of their various states and of the United States in the 1830s. So it's necessary in this period to be certainly keenly aware of one's own circumstances and to advocate, right, for one's own community. But in order to really be effective on this question, you have to understand the big picture of citizenship and belonging. And that is a picture that is not only one that includes African Americans, but includes what we would call white, European immigrants, Native people, Mexican, people of Mexican origin in the Southwest. It's a very complex and all-encompassing picture, even as it's pressing most acutely on African Americans in this early period.
Martha Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professors at Johns Hopkins University, where she teaches history. She is the author of the book Birthright Citizens, Race and Citizenship in Antebellum America. Martha Jones, I found that rewarding, and I thank you greatly.
Well, thank you very much for having me.